welcome to The Rest is History, the latest bonus episode, the third in this mighty trilogy of Tom Less episodes. So I am joined today once again. Tom is still on his holidays. So I'm joined once again by Dom Johnson, our producer, who's very kindly stepped in. It was going to be Jack, wasn't it, Dom? But Jack decided he was washing his hair today or whatever it is. So it's very good of you to come back again, because we had a great chat last time. We were just saying before we started, it's a very unusual experience for me to be talking uninterrupted. So it's brilliant to have you back on, Dom.
Oh, thank you very much for having me back. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Yeah, Jack sends his apologies. Don't think he'll appreciate the hair joke, but there we are.
Well, you have to see him to get that joke. So, Dom, what do you make of Tom's... So Tom has now moved on from... Where was he? He was in Greece, wasn't he?
Should we give the listeners a sort of... What where he's actually been in the last few weeks? So he flew out initially to Greece, did you say?
Yeah. I thought he went to Corfu, didn't he? For some festival.
Right.
And basically, it's a cricket tour disguised as a literary festival.
Appeared in Venice?
Yeah, La Serenissima. So he's in Venice. Well, the thing with Tom is he does this thing, I guess most of our listeners will know this, that he kind of live tweets his life, doesn't he? You know what he's doing every morning. A pigeon sat at his table 2 days ago and he put pictures of it on Twitter. And that it really is, actually, if you've ever been, I mean, you've been out and about with Tom, haven't you, Dom?
I mean, I have, yeah.
He does do this. He's always like taking photos of random things and fiddling with his phone, and it's absolutely not at all. The great thing is, it's not at all irritating that you're talking to him or you're encouraging him to do something, and he's in fact turned his back on you and is fiddling with his phone.
Is he a form of influencer, do you think?
Well, he's influencer
of his generation.
With his biscuit tea. But the question is, can you be an influencer if you don't actually have any influence? So, I've seen no evidence that people are genuinely influenced. Maybe are people seeking help from BetterHelp? Maybe they are, in which case I would take my hat off to Tom.
Athletic Greens.
He'd be doing, Athletic Greens, exactly. So Tom would be doing the kind of work that Prince Harry would very much approve of, encouraging people to explore their mental health issues. And I know Tom takes that very seriously, I think it's fair to say, isn't it, Dom?
Yeah, no, he definitely does. He definitely does. So I think on this podcast, while we've been wittering about the Spanish Civil War and Tony Wentler's talking about his journeys with Roy Keane in the last few, I think we need to crack through a few of the, a bit of the listener correspondence, if we can.
Because we put out an appeal, didn't we, for lots of questions. And we had tons and tons of questions. So do you want to kick off, Dom?
I had a question from Low Rays. It said, Dominic, I was wondering if you had done any books or planning any books covering the 80s after Who Dares Wins. I've loved the others. Being of a certain age, my life picked up about the time the miners' strike started. And I feel this impacted so much of the UK life that we're still seeing the ramifications today.
Okay, that's a good question. So for those, would everybody know? I suppose they wouldn't, especially if they just joined the Rest is History Club. So my sort of day job, as it were, is writing a massive post-war history of Britain, a series of books, of which I think there are now 5. And the most recent one, Who Dares Wins, ended in the summer of 1982 with Britain's victory in the Falklands War. And yes, Low Rays, I'm definitely doing the sequel to that, which is, I think some listeners will have heard this before, so apologies if you're bored. So it's really about the mid-80s in Britain. And the big event, as British listeners will know, maybe not our overseas listeners, was the miners' strike, the longest strike in British history, probably the most controversial industrial dispute, which took on the character. I mean, people referred to it as a civil war. It wasn't a civil war, but people talked to it in this very sort of melodramatic way. This titanic clash between Mrs. Thatcher and the miners' union. But there's lots of other things going on in the mid-80s. So computerization, the massive transformation of the City of London, into a bit of a backwater. I mean, obviously, it's still an important financial center, but it became supercharged with something called the Big Bang in 1986.
So on that, I can't remember which, was it in the Falklands War episode where Tom, I think there's a really interesting point Tom made where he said that Thatcher obviously enabled the Big Bang by deregulating the city and all that. And he said something like the excess it caused, and obviously London becoming this huge financial center and center of like the capitalism, I guess, global capitalism is alongside New York. Do you think Tom was saying that Thatcher is her personality should be someone who's sort of disgusted by all this sort of opulence and drinking and drug taking and this life excess? Or do you think she'd have been like, well, that's part and parcel. I'm just happy that it's.
No, I think she would have been quite censorious about that. So you know, personally, she never, for example, owned a credit card. She didn't believe in borrowing.
Oh, wow.
Ironically, given that she encouraged people to get mortgages to buy their houses. You know, she, yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the, she's a very controversial figure. So it would be, I wouldn't want to alienate a lot of listeners. But actually, she would be a great subject for a Restless History podcast or two, because so many of the things that people think about her are wrong, and there's so many little details that are surprising. So when she moved into number 10 as prime minister in 1979, you know, there was talk of sort of changing the layout, changing the flat and changing this and changing the, bringing new things in. But she went through all the details herself, kind of saying, oh, I've got my own ironing board. We don't need an ironing. Why are you spending so much on wallpaper? You know, very frugal. Completely the opposite of Boris.
No, Lulu Little.
Wanted, exactly, because Boris wanted to redecorate. And in fact, American presidents often redecorate the White House like a dog marking its territory. And this is obviously what Boris wanted to do with the number 10 flat, which got him into trouble. Mrs. Thatcher was having none of that. I mean, she was very austere in many ways.
Why was that? Due to her upbringing? And
upbringing, generation, also from a very, very strict Methodist family. So she at a given weekend, I mean, Tom would love all this because it's Christianity. at a given weekend when she was growing up in Grantham in Lincolnshire, they would go to church. She would go to chapel, rather, maybe four times at the weekend for multiple services or Sunday school and various things, because her father was a kind of lay preacher. He was an alderman in the town, but he was a very serious kind of low church, you know, kind of Methodist. And that absolutely kind of entered into her soul. She still absolutely had that kind of later in life. And I don't think you can actually understand her at all without understanding the influence of all that kind of thing. So as I said, it would be a good subject for Tom. He would enjoy all that. But yes, sorry. No, I am doing this book. I've done all the research for it. It's kind of partially written. It went on the back burner when I started doing Adventures in Time. So the combination of Adventures in Time and the podcast means that the delivery date has been delayed. But I am absolutely doing it, and probably will do another book, one more book in the series after that to get to the end of the 80s. So yes, is the short answer.
I think I saw someone on Discord quote you by saying that's sort of the point where your characters, or the characters you write about most, leave the stage, as in where you'd write. Yeah. Is that true?
1990 is the point where, so obviously Mrs. Thatcher leaves the stage in 1990. A lot of the people who have been, you know, there's a sort of generational shift at the beginning of the 1990s. So for a writer, you always have a cast, right? You have a kind of cast of characters. You have people who are kind of, you know, you, especially when you've been writing a series. I mean, there are five books. I'm looking at them now. There must be about 4,000 pages, something like that, probably, that I've done. So what that means is there are certain people who kind of come in and out of the narrative. They'll come into one book and then they come into another one. Mm. But obviously the series starts in the mid-50s. So by about 1990, a lot of those people, their heyday is over. They might die 10 years afterwards, but they're no longer, I mean, that's the way you think of any sort of national story, I suppose. Think of a stage and people are always coming on and off. And there are people who are coming to the front. So Tony Blair is at the front in the 1990s or the 2000s. But then he's not dead. I mean, he comes on again, you know, from time to time.
Cameos.
You'll see him in the headlines. Exactly. You'll see him in cameos. He's just there in the background. And then one day he walks off the stage and never returns. And your sort of challenge as a writer is, it's as though that's all going on in front of you, but you kind of have a camera that you're pointing at the stage. And who is it looking at any given moment? You know, at what point do you just forget about somebody? Do you bother even saying, mind, some people died? Is that a story? Is it interesting? I mean, for most people, it probably isn't, unless they're cut off in their prime or something. So yeah, a lot of the cast change at the end of the 80s. I don't know, the thought of writing about the major government just seems to me slightly boring.
Really? Do you think, is there parallels between now and the major government? I think someone was saying how, like, these self-inflicted scandals just keep coming out in this sort of latter stage of a...
Well, I think where there's a definite parallel is that there was a... I mean, I remember it very, very vividly. There was the Tories were in power for 18 years after 1979. So first Mrs. Thatcher and then John Major. Major was there for 7 years, so longer than most people remember, actually, longer than people think. But at the end, for the last 4 years or so, there was an absolute kind of fin de regime feel. Everybody knew they were going to lose and lose badly. And what was more, it was as though everything they touched just turned to ashes. You know, they couldn't kind of get anything right, and they were constantly feuding. And they just kept making terrible miscalculations and missteps, even though the weird thing is, actually, state of the country really wasn't that bad in the mid-1990s. We were going through an economic boom. But politically, it was just sort of self-inflicted wound after self-inflicted wound. And I think it's also, there's a point when the media just scent blood and they just say, this lot are finished. And I think there's definitely that sense. Now, I just don't, you know, you don't find columns in the newspapers now saying, do you know what, Liz Truss is actually brilliant and I think they're going to win in 2 years.
How much do you think that does set the tone? Because I remember it's probably about a year and a bit ago when the columnists are with Starmer, they're like, actually, he is boring. Maybe this isn't it. And then do you think that does sort of from the lobby to the columnist, does it permeate out to the general public and the sort of view of these politicians, or is it overstated, do you think?
I think it's a tiny bit overstated just because most people don't read newspapers,
yeah,
and certainly don't read columnists. So the common fantasy, which is especially popular on the left, but you now start to see it on the right as well, the slight conspiracy theory fantasy, which is people are brainwashed by the mainstream media, slightly misses the fact that actually most people, all of these things that you think of the mainstream media, most people don't consume them at all. An awful lot of people get their news from Facebook or from just their friends, or they just don't, as it were, get the news at all, other than what they observe in their day-to-day lives and some vague sense of what the radio, you know, one headlines are. So we've had a few suggestions since we started this whole rest is history that we should do newspapers, history of newspapers. And I think it's a really interesting subject because I always think there's a kind of dance going on between what the newspaper thinks and what the public thinks. And one is not actually, you know, the newspapers are not brainwashing the public, basically. I mean, I'm really struck by this because quite often I talking to people who work in newspapers, they'll sort of say, well, we've taken this line because that's what the readers think, or that's what the readers will think. So actually, they don't perceive themselves as brainwashing the public. They think of themselves as anticipating and reflecting what the readers will think. They try to sort of work out where the readers are, rather than necessarily to sort of influence them or to bend them in some way. So, yeah, I think with the trust thing, I would say that there's just a, don't you think, Dom, that there's a just a general mood
malaise
that you can't quite define and or put your finger on? Anyway, sorry, I'm talking too much.
No, I agree. Sorry, no. That's very interesting. So I think we talked about on the last bonus challenges and struggles and the differences between podcasting and the BBC.
Yes.
And we've got a few messages here off the back of that from Bits Duverect.
I was wondering if you were going to try reading that. Bits Duverect. Yeah, Verrückt. I don't know how you'd say that. Yeah.
The challenges of allowing people to have Discord nicknames. So he's basically touching on the fact he listened to Rana Mitter on In Our Time, and he actually found Rana a bit pompous and boring to listen to, he said. But in the rest of history episode...
My word, that's harsh.
The worst thing you can be described as.
Yeah.
In the Victorian age, I think, isn't it? And then it says, but in the rest of his history episode, he was very down to earth and interesting. Must be a host creating a better environment. As someone who's spoken to Rana, not as much as you have, he's not pompous at all. He's a very nice guy.
Yeah.
And Julian X said... Melvin Bragg, that is, on In Our Time, has a certain air that makes academics nervous. I've heard him cross the line with it in years gone by, interrupting, overbearing, restrictive.
You'd never get that on our podcast.
No, so you'd never get that. But he's saying, I think what people are getting at here is, did you set out, someone's asked, to sort of make the rest of history the antithesis of In Our Time? Do you consciously do it, or do you think it's just something that's created naturally?
So that's a really good question. And for those people who don't know, so those non-British listeners, In Our Time is a kind of BBC institution. It runs every week. It's an extraordinary program. It runs for 45 minutes. The host is a sort of veteran presenter called Melvin Bragg, and he has three academics on every week. So it runs on Radio 4, which is that kind of most prestigious radio, kind of talk radio channel. And they do a different topic each week. And it's generally science, literature, or history. And it's completely random things. So it could be the 30 Years' War 1 week. The next week, it is electrons.
Wittgenstein.
Or it could be something sometimes incredibly niche. So the genesis of Don Quixote or the planet Neptune. You know, it's completely random. And Melvin is the kind of, he's the compare, but he's also the voice of the audience to some extent. Now, I think... Tom and I both listen to In Our Time. It's the one program that we would sometimes say to each other when we're preparing an episode, there's a good In Our Time on this. You should listen to this.
And do you listen to it?
Yeah, I do. So, I mean, I don't always. And I don't actually have time now that we're doing so many podcasts. But I do listen to In Our Time. I never listen to the science ones, obviously. But I listen to the history and literature ones, and I really enjoy them. Although, tragically, I often think, oh, I could really sort of educate myself, but actually, I don't really remember much of what I, you know, after about a week, I've forgotten all the...
This is an interesting point that a lot of Rest is History friends of the show say on the Discord. They say, absolutely love the podcast, just joined up. Don't remember anything of what's said, but really enjoy it.
Yeah, I know, it's tragic. So what Melvin does is he can be downright, rude is too much, because I love that. He's very impatient with the academics. He will say, you know, I'm just trying to think.
On the Wittgenstein one, yeah, he says, this guy goes off on his absolute spiel about it. He asks him a very clear question. Yeah. Stop. You've not understood. Come right back.
Yeah, he does that. So there are a couple of people who are brilliant. So there's always one guy who I've always thought he's so good. He's called Alan Knight, and he does anything whenever there's a subject about, he did the Aztecs, he did the Mexican Revolution. He does things like this. He was a professor at Oxford. And he's brilliant. Melvin will say, Alan Knight from the University of Oxford, what were the causes of the Mexican Revolution? And he'll do it in 3 minutes. Bang, 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 bang. Like really focused, wow. Really disciplined. But then he'll ask somebody else and they'll start waffling and they'll dither. And Melvin has a habit of, there are particular kinds of academics. I think I said this on the Discord. There's a particular kind of academic who's kind of a bit dithery and a bit kind of very well-meaning and very earnest. And if they hesitate a bit or if they're nervous, it brings out his kind of inner bully. And he just gets more and more impatient. Hurry up, or whatever. That's not what I asked you. And anybody who's at all pretentious,
he hates.
He really goes for them. Now, I actually relish that. I love it when he's being so rude to them.
So how does it relate to the Rest is History, do you think, as a show? Did you take inspiration from it when you start, or was it?
Well, sometimes, Tom, Tom's obviously not here, and I'm normally very rude about him behind his back, obviously, just because I'm a horrible person. But one thing I will say about Tom is that Tom will sometimes text me after we've done an episode and when it's gone out, and he'll say, I listened back to our episode and I listened to the In Our Time, and ours was so much better. He takes enormous pleasure in when he thinks we've been better than In Our Time. I think we're just not in our time. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's funny. Last week, we were talking about people disliking some things like the fashion or whatever. And I said, well, you know, I wondered if you'd cut this out, actually. Because I said, it's our podcast, you know, if you don't like it, boo-boo.
Kept it in.
And it is kind of, we didn't think, oh, we have to make it, we're in the shadow of In Our Time. We just thought, this is just our thing of us wittering on and occasionally having the odd guest. Mm. And we're not in our time. We're not an encyclopedia. We're not an academic monograph. So I don't really view it as it's just a different beast.
Yeah.
It's just not, I mean, Melvin Bragg is never going to do Marilyn Monroe, is he? He's never going to sing Marilyn Monroe. I mean, he could do it as a subject, I'm sure, and he would do it much more sensibly, I suppose, than we did it.
So you think the Rana point is just, it's a completely different atmosphere. It's like having a conversation on stage or in a pub.
Exactly. They sit round a table.
Yeah.
So I actually know the producer of In Our Time, and she books all the guests and all this sort of thing. And she's brilliant. They sit round a table and they do it live, and they're all sitting there with their notes. They've done a briefing call beforehand where they've been told what they want them to talk about and what they're going to say. Melvin is like really informed. He's got all his notes, but he's also got the clock.
Mm.
You know, it's not like a podcast.
We don't have a clock.
He's got the clock and they've got to be done in 45 minutes. And there's no way they can possibly be 45 minutes and 10 seconds. So it's just stiffer. They may not have met each other beforehand. You know, they're in there. They're wearing the BBC visitor's pass.
Lanyard.
They've been sat down around the table by the production staff. That lends itself to a kind of formality, which you don't get when you're just talking to your friend.
Of course.
On Zoom. You know, I think that's the big difference.
Definitely. And so what have we got here? We've got Kapil Loft, friend of the show, frenemy of the show.
He's a friend of the show. I find him, some listeners I know were cross with him because of his abuse of Ted Valance and his massive overpraise of Charles I. I find him enormously amusing. So again, boo-hoo. go on, Tom.
Sorry, so Kapil Loft said, can you do an episode on the Crimean War? Only major war involving Britain between Waterloo and World War I, and yet shamefully little is known about it. A certain topicality too. Thoughts?
He's not wrong. The Crimean War is an excellent subject. Orlando Figes wrote a very good book on this, which I reviewed about 8 years ago, and the Crimean War. It is a good subject. I would be well up for doing it, actually. We could work in a bit of Flashman, Battle of Balaclava, Charge of the Light Brigade. Tom could read some poetry. I think it would be a very good subject. So yes, agreed. Completely.
Is that
agreed.
The war where they had picnics? Like they'd have high society people going out and watching the battle unfold?
I haven't heard that. Maybe that's the Napoleonic Wars, I would have said. Crimean War is quite a long way. Maybe people did go as tourists. I don't know. Obviously, the Crimean War is the war of war correspondents. You've got the Telegraph. You've got Florence Nightingale and Mary Seacole.
First photographs, I think, as well.
Yeah, exactly. So it's the first kind of media war to some extent, or modern media war.
Yeah, there was, I think there was a bit of, it says Mark Twain visited in the Bodleian here.
Oh, right. Okay, well, that shows what I know.
No, no, I think... Yeah, it's the idea of war tourism. Does that still, it still sort of happens now, war tourism, doesn't it? I think John Sweeney's come under a bit of flack in Ukraine.
For war tourism?
Well, it's not
really?
Tourism, is it?
Walking but, around doing his reports? I mean, I don't think that's tourism.
No, but it's, yeah.
I think...
He's without a publication, isn't he? I think he's just doing it off his own back.
But people, that's not tourism, is it? I mean, I think that's... people do that. People travel to wars. I mean, look at Churchill in their podcast when he went to Cuba. He was a war tourist.
But he didn't have a publication in Cuba, did he?
Did he have a publication? I think he... I can't remember now. I think he did. I think he did. But I mean, if I went to Ukraine now, Dom...
Yes.
I mean, I would love to, if you said... If you and Jack said, we're going to go to Lviv and we're going to do a Rest Is History Live from Lviv, maybe talk to the mayor or something or whatever. Are you up for it? First of all, I am up for it. I'd definitely go. But... I think some listeners would say, isn't this a bit weird and exploitative that you're going to a war zone?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, is that different from any other form of journalism?
Mm.
I don't know. We're not going to do it, by the way.
Well, funnily enough, spoke to a few people when I was recording an episode in Albania for a different podcast. And some of the Albanian officials there said, we went to Kiev. You should do a live podcast there. And people were like, yeah, well, it'd be great. We'll get the train. Luckily, we didn't organize one for October.
I texted Tom about 2 weeks ago, and I said, when the Ukrainian war is over and Ukraine has won, we should go to Ukraine and do a Rest Is History. That would be a great foreign trip for the Rest Is History. We could go to some of the historic sites, but we could also talk to people, and I just think it would be a brilliant, brilliant thing to
definitely
do, and I'd be completely up for doing it.
That's the boost that the Ukrainian people need.
Vladimir Zelensky will be beside himself when he hears that the Rest Is History is considering at some point coming to Ukraine.
Excellent. Right. So Stephen Watson, massive praise for the Churchill podcast, which is not uncommon. There's been a lot. People have loved the young Churchill episodes. He said he loved the ever-increasing list of terrible people in it. He said, please, can I ask, which would you most like to be stuck with on a desert island? John Lennon, David Lloyd George, or one of Churchill's parents?
Least like to be stuck with, probably John Lennon.
Least. And
least,
most.
Yeah. Of the four.
I think you and Randolph would get on. You're not his heir.
No. I mean, I'm thinking about Jenny Churchill, Jenny Jerome, society beauty, very rich. She might be very annoying.
She's away from her comforts.
Yeah, I don't feel that I'm not convinced we'd have a great chemistry. I think actually the person, I think I'd probably get on really well. I think he's an absolute rake, a cad, a terrible man. But I imagine I would genuinely get on well with David Lloyd George. Because I like a character. I like somebody who's funny and clever. He's obviously both.
Yeah.
So I think what would be toxic is if I were on the island with Lloyd George, Mrs. Churchill, and, you know,
and
with those two.
That'd be carnage.
Because he would not leave her alone. And then there would be all kinds of issues. So,
yeah. So John Lennon, definitely not. He's not there for you.
John Lennon's not. No, I don't see us as soulmates.
That'd be Tom's ideal holiday.
Tom loves John Lennon. Tom likes John Lennon a lot. I mean, when I first met Tom, you know, almost 20 years ago, he was very excited about things to do with John Lennon, and I just couldn't get my head around it, to be honest with you. So
great. And so also on the Churchill episodes, Michael Merrick said, I'd love to know how much of Churchill's later exploits, Boer War, etc., got through to his mother and whether this changed their relationship at all.
Yes, it did change their relationship. They became more like equals. They both needed money. So they were kind of a slightly more of a joint enterprise by that point. But also, she goes to the Boer War. What did she do? Did she come on a ship? I'm doing live research here to remind myself. Yeah, on a hospital ship, the RFA Maine.
Oh.
She went to the war. She chartered it, and she was decorated by her old flame, King Edward VII, on my birthday, actually, on the 2nd of October. 1902, for her efforts for the men in the war. So, yes. So, and I think she did think more highly of Winston by then because he'd clearly shown himself to be, you know, a more admirable person than his father had bargained for.
I was listening back to them, and the extent to which they were horrible to him was sort of unbelievable to me. It almost seemed like it was like an active effort. Do you think was it because he was a really supremely arrogant kid, or was it just literally the way their sort of strata society treated their children? Because it just to me it's like an active effort to be horrible.
I don't get on at all with the argument that it's the way,
right?
Because I think it's so much of a caricature of the Victorians to say rich Victorians were monstrous to their kids. They weren't. They did send their children to boarding schools, but I mean, not only do people send their children to boarding schools today, and not just in Britain, by the way, but that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, that they hate them. I mean, they may have thought it was the right thing for them. I think the Churchills were unusually narcissistic and self-indulgent. That may be why they were attracted to each other. I mean, and they just regard their children as a terrible distraction and as an intrusion on their social kind of routines.
Right.
Lord Randolph is incredibly egotistical and basically doesn't want any competition for attention, which maybe Winston and Jenny just resents the fact that the children interfere with her kind of whirl of parties and affairs and things. So
wouldn't you just blank them out from your life and just never send anything to them? Why are they so damning in their sort of correspondence with them?
Well, that's a good question, Dom, because you could, you're right. You're absolutely right. They could have been just very absent, distant and uncaring parents, absent parents, without just being so horrible. Lord Randolph is horrible because his own life hasn't really worked out. His political career has been a failure. He's shot himself in the foot by resigning, and then there's no way back, and he's bitter, and he's a bully. I think he takes it out on his son.
Okay.
And Jenny, she thinks Winston is tiresome, you know? I think she's just irritated and resentful that she even has to have letters from this child at all. I mean, I think they're just horrible. Sometimes they're just really nasty people.
I was taken by your point where you said him holding hands with his nanny in boarding school. And you said as someone who also went to boarding school, and if you'd done that in your time, you'd have all equally it'd have been social suicide.
I can't conceive of the situation.
How would Churchill, do you think, have got on growing up when you did, going to boarding school and living out his life?
That's a good question. I mean, how would he get on today?
Yeah, I suppose.
In schools of any kind, being a self-confident character is often rewarded, isn't it? It doesn't actually matter what role you play, as long as you play that role with gusto, particularly among teenage boys. Teenage boys respect kind of confidence. Mm. Even if you're quite a loner and you do your own thing in a very weird and wacky way, if you do it, if you really sort of go for it wholeheartedly, bye-bye, often I think the other boys will just kind of, you know, they'll let you get on with it and they'll respect you for it. I think Churchill would have been popular. He was sporty. He obviously won that. I mean, for example, he won that. He goes on about what a dud he is. But he won that fencing competition, the public school's fencing competition. Now, I don't even think you need to have been to a boarding school to know that to win a big competition like that involving lots of schools, when you're sort of 16 or 17, that's a pretty big deal. I mean, that's kind of the highlight of your year, and everybody knows that you've won it.
Mm.
So he was an achiever. He won prizes, you know. He was also a character. So I think he'd probably have thrived at any point. He had this sort of personality. It's quite irrepressible personality.
Yeah,
and I think that means that he'd have actually got on pretty well at any stage.
Interesting. And so, what have we got here? David Platt. The best film TV Churchill was undoubtedly Robert Hardy in Churchill, The Wilderness Years. Fantastic drama in every way. Appeasers as baddies and Chamberlain as hopeless. Baldwin fares little better, but is portrayed as a more effective politician than his successor. You agree?
Yeah. So I had never seen that, and I still have never really seen it, but I was aware it existed and people started talking about it on the Discord, and I watched some YouTube clips yesterday when I was I was procrastinating when I was meant to be working. So I thought, I'll watch a bit of The Wilderness Years on YouTube. And I think it looks great. It's very, very kind of, you know, court politics. So it's set in the 1930s, I think 8 episodes. They're pretty much all set either in Churchill's house or in the cabinet room or in the House of Commons. Must have been a pretty expensive serial. I think it's about 1981 or 82 because they have a big cast and they've, I guess, built a replica of the House of Commons, and it looks pretty good. Now, the Baldwin and Chamberlain portrayals are excellent. They are very good. And that is high praise, because I'm normally very scathing about portrayals of sort of 20th century politicians in dramas. But they're brilliant. And the Baldwin in particular is very good. He's the best Stanley Baldwin I've seen. Derek Jacobi does him in The Gathering Storm, and I think is reasonably useless. I mean, not that Derek Jacobi is not a good actor, but he's just not right. Peter Barkworth, who was in the first Ice Warriors story in Doctor Who, for those people who like Doctor Who from the 1960s, he's Stanley Baldwin, and he is really good. I mean, he's as good as, it's almost like they've got Stanley Baldwin. And the Neville Chamberlain is very good as well, because Neville Chamberlain would be a brilliant subject for our podcast, because everybody gets him wrong. I was only having a chat last week to Robert Harris,
oh, yeah,
the novelist, about Neville Chamberlain, because Robert Harris wrote, an excellent book called Munich, about a historical novel.
Turned into a film
with Jeremy Irons as Chamberlain. And what Robert Harris got really right in Munich was that Chamberlain was not a wimp. Chamberlain was an extremely arrogant, self-confident, clever, immensely effective administrator, a political kind of an absolute big beast who no one dared argue with, who absolutely believed in his own ability. And that's what led him into this business with Hitler, because he thought he could do it. He could fix it.
Oh, right.
You know, it wasn't weediness and all that stuff. I mean, of course, Chamberlain had a horror of war, but I mean, any sane person in the 1930s had a horror of war, because they'd lived through the First World War and they'd seen what it could do. Baldwin the same. So the Chamberlain in the in Munich, but also the Chamberlain in the Wilderness Years, they're tough. Chamberlain has to be tough. And if you don't get that kind of hardness of him, then you don't get him right at all. And the Baldwin in the Wilderness Years is kind of feline and cunning, which Baldwin was, because you wouldn't be prime minister three times unless you were. So that what they get, I think, is that the actor doing it, Peter Barkworth, he also gets, Baldwin had all these mannerisms with his pipe and he was quite slow. But all of this was a front.
Right.
It was all concealing this very calculating, kind of ruthless political mind. So I'm going to watch the whole thing through properly, but it looked splendid.
So Arena on the Discord, she opened a can of worms by saying, who did the best Churchill? She raised Churchill in The Crown. And then Aurelius nominated Gary Oldman in Darkest Hour.
No.
And then you charged in with Albert Finney.
I did. Yeah. So The Gathering Storm, which I mentioned, is a lovely film. It's a tiny bit sensationalized in a few points, but it's mainly really about the relationship between Churchill and Clemmy in the years of appeasement when he's out of office. But Finney does him. He captures Churchill's ebullience, the fact that he can be very self-indulgent, the fact that he is very vain, the fact that he can be very annoying and tiresome, because that relationship that he has with Vanessa Redgrave, who plays Clementine Churchill, she's often absolutely furious with him or despairs of him. He's such a spendthrift. He's so self-interested, all this kind of stuff. But he also makes Churchill incredibly endearing. And I love The Gathering Storm. And I think Albert Finney's Churchill was very influential, I would say. After Robert Hardy's, it was the most influential. So, for example, Tom's impersonation of Churchill, which was, I thought, you know, very good fun.
A return to form.
His three increasingly, a return to form, maybe, yeah. Let's be generous. A return to form. I think ultimately most impersonations of Churchill, including my own and Tom's, are really impersonations of Albert Finney.
Right.
Because it was so influential.
That's a mark of...
Yeah, a mark of set. I think Gary Oldman's Churchill is no good. Now, that's controversial because he won an Oscar for that.
Mm.
But I don't like it. I don't think it's right.
Yes. Well, yeah. Well, anyone who wants to give their two cents on that, they can reply on the Discord to Arena's message. So, Dominic, I've seen you've been slightly traitorous in terms of appearing on podcasts this week. Would you like to speak about that?
Sure. So I was invited on by a Rest is History listener called Graham. Actually, Dom. So it's very much in the interests of bolstering the morale of the Rest is History Club. A Rest is History listener called Graham, who is a tax expert, who said, would you consider appearing on our podcast about tax, which I think is listened to by some accountants and tax lawyers. A lot of it is about tax law. So I sort of said, I'm not really an expert on tax, but I will come on your podcast. So I believe they're billing it as the making of the modern tax base.
Wow.
which is a title to conjure with, Dom. And you know what? We recorded for about 2 hours.
Really?
I'd set aside, I'd thought, this will be done and dusted in about 40 minutes max. But it went on for 2 hours because they were very, Graham and Harriet, his co-presenter, were extremely knowledgeable about taxation, it's fair to say, which you would hope for from tax lawyers. And they were very interested in the history and in the kind of political and economic context from the 1940s to the present. So if you are interested in tax,
international
and
tax
in economic bites. History, I guess it's about the political economy of Britain from the 1940s to the 1990s or so. This is absolutely the podcast for you because it's out, I believe, this week, this very week.
Yeah, it's called International Tax Bites. And as you said, presented by Harriet Brown and Graham Jackson. And Graham's a Wang, is he? Or just a listener?
I think.
Well, this hinges on it. Might have to cut this whole bit if he's not a friend of the show.
No, I think he's a Wang. I think he contacted me through the Discord.
Great. I've realized we've got some housekeeping to do. Tom has been in touch and he's insisted on a few messages to be read out.
Tom Holland.
Would you like me to read them out?
We can read them out and we'll treat them with the respect they deserve.
Joe Evans Green. Why is Dominic so jealous of Tom's uncanny ability to impersonate any celebrity?
It's very sweet. It's very sweet and very revealing, Dom.
Yeah.
That Tom thinks that Joe Evans Green is being serious.
Simon Clark. There should be the Rest is History podcast devoted solely to Tom's impressions, sort of like a greatest hits.
Again, it's very sweet that Tom thinks Simon Clarke is not being sarcastic.
Peter Williamson, would Tom ever consider taking a coruscating one-man musical to Edinburgh in which he plays Churchill and Marilyn Monroe while sitting on a stool on a bare stage?
I would, if people wanted to crowdfund it and Tom agreed to do it, and he would do precisely that. He would sit on a stool on a bare stage and do Churchill and Marilyn Monroe. I pledge that I would put in £5,000.
£5,000. I think we could do it.
Would you not pay Tom? I think anyone. I mean, Dom. Anybody would want to pay to see Tom do that.
£5,000. I think I could put it on for that, and we could.
He would. That would be life defining.
Career
ending. Tom Holland. It would be the funniest thing imaginable. But he'd have to do it for a week. Not just a one-off. It's a week run. Tom Holland sings Churchill and Marilyn Monroe at the Edinburgh Festival. I think a lot of the newspapers would review that. They would give it absolutely... The reviews would be something to behold. I would go to every performance with enormous relish. I think that would be absolutely superb. And I've made my pledge now. And I would, I mean, imagine. The thing is, he'll never do it because it interferes with the cricket season.
True. And it would be, I think so it would be seen as a sort of Ron Davies, Clapham Common moment, wouldn't it, for Tom Holland?
Moments of madness. Yeah, it'd be one of those things that you just, no one will be able to read his books again without thinking of him on that stage singing Marilyn Monroe in an Edinburgh pub or something. In August 2023.
Watch out for it. We might have to make it happen. So I think, I wonder if you've seen this on Twitter this week, doing the rounds amongst some of the Rest is History circles. It's a local resident interviewed in a magazine, and she responds to being asked about the school history curriculum. And she says, "I hate history. I think just Henry VIII and the Second World War is enough." Do you think,
yes.
What do you respond to that, Dominic, as someone who's done 2 years worth of podcasts on other topics as well?
Well, all I will say is the first two volumes in the Adventures in Time series, Dom, are the Six Wives of Henry VIII and the Second World War.
Ah.
So you could well argue that. So that was very funny. I hate history. I just think that Henry VIII and the Second World War are enough. That was funny because the sort of caricature version, the parody that people have of English schools' history is that people only do the Nazis and the Tudors. I mean, this will mean nothing to our overseas listeners. But basically, in England, people always say, kids only learn about Henry VIII and Hitler. That's all. And the truth is, they're the two most popular subjects of public history in this country. In some way, I mean, there's no point arguing with it for obvious reasons. I mean, people like them because Henry VIII, because you've got the soap opera drama with the wives, but also it's against the backdrop of this kind of titanic clash between Protestantism and Catholicism. So it's a good story and it's got good costumes. And, you know, you can read your Hilary Mantel and stuff. And then why wouldn't people be interested in the Nazis and the Second World War? You know, people are interested in good versus evil. They're interested in high melodrama, I suppose. So, I thought that was very funny. Actually, you know what? school, I don't know if we've got many history teachers. I think we have a few history teachers who are. And history teachers get, and history teaching generally gets a pretty bad rap. You know, people say, oh, they should be doing this. It drives me absolutely bonkers. I see it all the time, every single week on Twitter. You know, I'm tagged into a whole host of historians are sort of tagged into this conversation, which is, it's a disgrace that our children are not doing. And it's usually one of about three things. It'll be slavery, Ireland, or China. Those kinds of things. And I never bother replying to this because I think there's just no point. But because the single issue is most children, or a lot of children in Britain, do 40 minutes of history a week.
Mm.
And if that is all you're doing, for all that all people can wax lyrical about their pet fashionable topic, there's actually not that much time. So fine, you think they have to do all these things. It's a disgrace they don't do the British Empire. And I sort of think, the British Empire is a bloody big topic.
Yeah.
It lasts for like 300, 400 years. Which bit are you going to do? You're going to do all of it in a year? I mean, 400 years in a year is a lot. Are you going to do India and you're going to do Africa and you're going to do Ireland and you're going to do the Far East and you're going to do Egypt? Of course you can't do all this. So that kind of makes my blood boil a bit, because I think history teaching becomes then a bit of a sort of political football, and that people just say, oh, our children should just learn the fashionable sort of topic of the day. The other thing is, I mean, I heard this a lot. I've heard this, frankly, from a couple of guests on The Rest Is History. It was terrible that at school I wasn't taught about X. I just think, you're not an idiot. There are libraries. There's people have invented the internet. If you're that bothered about it, inform yourself. Don't beat up on your school or your teachers because they didn't happen to do that particular area that you are now interested in the curriculum. I mean, I think personally, people often say to me, what should history teachers teach? And I always sort of say, well, I know what I would teach. And I sort of putting my own hat on, there are things that I think kids should do, but ultimately they should just do whatever they think is fun and they will be really enthusiastic about it, and they think the children will really enjoy. I don't think there's any, I don't think anybody has any right actually to be prescriptive and to say, I'm really interested about this and I think it's politically very important and therefore everybody should do it. I just think that's really incredibly tiresome. Sorry, that turned into a rant when it was good.
A
response to some, this is what happens when Tom is away, because Tom would have interrupted after about 10 seconds of that. but Dominic, and then I'd never have got going.
I think it's a great point. And I think you're right. Do you think it's sort of, it should be viewed as sort of, if you study history at school, as you say, only 40 minutes a week in some cases, it should be a great gateway to sort of generate interest in it, get people through the door, teach them the Nazis. Teachers have done it a lot of times. And then when they're at university, they can, if they do it at university, they can expand there. But do you think that what you say about guests there, do you think that's that interesting thing where some people make it big and they do well in life and they sort of retrospectively say, oh, at school I had these teachers, they beat me down. They didn't give me any of the opportunities, and sort of doing it that way rather than, I'm sure at school, they must've been fairly good history teachers if they're now historians.
Right, exactly. I think there's definitely an element to that. That's the Churchill element thing, isn't it?
It is.
He mythologized his own early life. Oh, I was rubbish at school, all this. Because then it makes the trajectory, the triumph against the odds, much better. So I think people do that a bit. And the thing about the Nazis, I mean, sometimes teachers say this to me when I go to school. They say, do you know why we do this particular topic? It's because there are loads of resources. The school already has a lot of the stuff, so we don't have to spend a lot of money on new things. The kids really enjoy it. It brings the kids in. Exactly that, Dom. I mean, it's not like you shouldn't do the Third Reich. If doing the Third Reich brings in kids, you've got all the stuff. The teacher knows about it. They're very enthusiastic. There's tons of materials. They can go onto YouTube. They can go onto the BBC pages. I don't think that's... I mean, I did the Nazis, by the way, at GCSE.
Did I?
And I really enjoyed it. I learned a lot from it.
Here we are.
It was good historical training. And here we are, exactly. I think teachers, they have institutional pressures, right? They have to attract people to do history and then get good results.
Yeah.
So it's all very well saying to them, do you know what I think you should do? I think you should do... I mean, people will laugh at this sort of because of this is going to be a very parodically Daily Mail thing to say. I think you should do some 12th century, Senegalese empire, because that would be really diverse. But if you are the sort of teacher, you're sitting there in your empty classroom planning over the summer, and your head in your hands thinking, I know nothing about this. There are no resources. Nobody has produced all the kind of the little clips that I need to sell. The students have never heard of it, so they don't want to do it. They're all doing geography instead. I'm about to be fired. That's basically that's the trajectory. Now, of course, I'm massively caricaturing this, but you know what I mean. I think it's very easy to sort of, everybody's an expert when it comes to history teaching. That's part of the trouble.
Right then, Dominic, I think we've been talking for long enough this week again. We don't do a Tom Holland bonus. He does a tight 30 minutes.
Does he?
He does, yeah.
It's because he's not interested in what you have to say.
Yeah, the handbrake's off. I think you're right. No, I meant you and him, not me and him.
Oh, yeah, he and I do a tight 30.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
The same thing. Maybe he's not interested in what I know.
So. Interesting, I think. Great. So yeah. We've got a few. We've been recording. Well, we're recording World Cup episodes, aren't we? This mammoth Herculean effort.
So hilariously, the listeners will enjoy this. We got a message from Tony, our executive producer, who you may remember from a couple of weeks ago, and he said,
"The hairdryer,
lads, I'm a little bit concerned about the World Cup. You know, you've talked this up." And there are 32 episodes to record because there are 32 countries taking part. And I'm having a quick look and it looks like you've recorded seven. Yeah. I think five of which are mine, Dom, and two are Tom's.
Exactly.
And he said, what's going on? I got that email or that WhatsApp within about an hour of another WhatsApp from Tom Holland that said, I've been thinking about our schedule. Obviously, we've got a lot to do with the World Cup coming up. But I've been thinking that instead of doing one episode on the Battle of Trafalgar, and my heart kind of rose, instead of doing Trafalgar, he was going to say, we'll concentrate on the World Cup episodes. He said, I think we should do three episodes on the Battle of Trafalgar and do a massive preamble about the Royal Navy. I've been on holiday and I've been reading all these books about the Royal Navy, and that's what we should do. So we've got, you know, my diary is now like just full of Tom Holland. with Tom's Nelsonian enthusiasm. So we're going to be recording that. We are also going to be recording about the World Cup, aren't we, Tom? So
yeah, we've done Costa Rica.
So we've done Costa Rica. We've done Brazil. We've done Denmark. We've done the Rif War. We've done Cameroon's top general. I am looking forward to recording about South Korean courtesans, about the Seven Wonders of Poland, about the White Rose Movement in Germany, about Uruguayan guerrillas, and about the Carnation Revolution in Portugal. And Tom has stuff up his sleeve, but he's meant to have been preparing, but actually in reality, he's just been reading, ironically, about rope and rigging on 18th century ships.
He'll pull it out of the bag. He's done an absolutely brilliant episode on Australia.
He has done, to be fair, yeah. I give Tom a hard time sometimes, but that Australian episode is one of the most fascinating episodes we have ever had on the Rest Is History.
I think I'd go that far. Excellent. Well, I think that's enough today, Dominic.
So what have we got coming? We've got France.
We've got French films of French history through film. I think
that is a great episode. I'm sure people really enjoy that.
It's brilliant. Brilliant guest. And then we've got the Trafalgar series will be coming up.
Yeah. And then Lady Jane Grey is somewhere down the line, isn't she?
Yes, somewhere down the line.
Waiting for
And then
for
we'll
her
have
moment.
An interesting episode on treason.
Yeah, so we're doing, we're going to, I think I can say without giving it away, I'm giving it away. we're going to the National Archives. They have a huge new show about treason, the history of treason. And so Tom and I are going to go and do a kind of location Rest Is History, being shown around the exhibition, looking at all the exhibits and all the documents and stuff, which I think will be absolutely fascinating. And Tom will be back, believe it or not, next week.
Next week.
Yeah, we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.